This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
It's just gone past 11:30 a.m. on Sunday morning, which means that the next half an hour on the 3CR airwaves are dedicated to our coasts and oceans. You're listening to Out of the Blue. My name is Tessa Campisi. As always, my voice is beaming to you from the unceded lands and waters of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. I pay respect to elders past and present. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Today on Out of the Blue, we're lucky enough to have PhD candidate Jack Manera back on the show. Jack studies behavioural ecology and ecotoxicology at Monash University, with a particular focus on how humans are impacting the behavioural responses of marine biota. And if you're anything like me, you're constantly wondering about what's going on inside the minds of our fishy little friends. And so I couldn't help myself, and I dragged Jack back out of the lab and into the studio to talk about a bit more of his research.
Lovely to have you back in the studio, Jack. Last time you came on the show, we talked about how pharmaceutical compounds can act as a toxin in the water and can impact marine biota. But today we're going to be looking at a different kind of pollution. We're going to look at sound pollution. So maybe first up, can you tell me about how sound behaves differently in water compared to above the water?
Yeah, sound's a funny one. We obviously don't see it, and humans are very much visual creatures. So I feel like when you say to someone, when you mention the word pollution, people instantly think about plastic bags in the ocean or oil spills or road runoff and things like that. We often forget about the fact that the noise we make and all our various activities produce a lot of noise. Noise pollution is this really insidious sort of pollutant that we do typically forget about quite often. And what makes it even worse is that our hearing structures are designed to hear on land and hear sound in our atmosphere. Mm. But sound operates very differently underwater. So much so that, without getting too nerdy about it, in the atmosphere we sort of rely on just one aspect of noise, and we only hear one aspect or one property, whereas underwater there's actually two properties and they both contribute equally. Mm. So there's this whole other sort of side of sound that we don't really perceive properly. But more than that, sound actually travels faster, further, and at greater intensity underwater than on land. So any noise we do make there, it spreads further, louder, and yeah, it can be very detrimental. And a lot of the species there, because of the fact that sound travels so well underwater, a lot of marine species actually have evolved to rely on sound. So you can think about all the echolocation and all the whales and dolphins and things like that. We're now discovering that a lot of fish are actually communicating with sounds, which is something people previously didn't think happened.
Yeah, interesting. I know that there's been some really interesting work doing, is it reef restoration, by using sound as a way to attract fish towards an area where there previously wasn't any coral, because the sound of the little...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's sort of mimicking this ecosystem sort of enrichment style. Yeah, it's attracting all these species back to sections of reef that maybe traditionally were deteriorating because of human activities or something, or maybe historical bleaching events, and they're able to reattract species back and sort of bring back that biodiversity, at least in that spot. So, yeah, super interesting. And it just, again, shows how, a lot of marine species do rely on sound.
Mm. So, yeah, sound very important in the ocean, but there are many sources of noise pollution now in our oceans. Would you be able to talk about some of those sources and how they compare to naturally occurring sounds in the ocean?
Yeah, for sure. So humans make a lot of noise underwater from various different things. Mining and resource exploration creates a lot of noise, actually. So a lot of the mining and resource exploration uses these big sort of sonar arrays. And essentially what they're doing is they're projecting these sound waves off the sea floor, and they can then map out where there's potential resources for them to mine.
Mm, like the seismic blasting in the Otway Basin.
Exactly. And that's horrendous. I mean, these sounds are... at such high intensities that they can like rupture swim bladders of fish that are underneath them and things like that. So these are pretty crazy events. It is restricted to where they are exploring at that point in time, which makes it slightly better because it's not affecting everything all at once. And a case of where that's happening is our transportation network. So humans obviously have this vast sort of network of ships and boats that travels around the world for cargo, for recreational reasons, ecotourism, everything. And so these shipping lanes span all our oceans from ports to ports. And then we've obviously got people boating up and down coastlines, up and down river systems. So yeah, it's pretty ubiquitous. There was a long-term monitoring study done off the coast of California, actually. Mm. And they found that human boating alone has resulted in a 10 decibel increase in the entire world's ocean. Like the baseline volume of the ocean, which is crazy. It's hard because it's underwater, so it's hard for me to explain what that would be like, but above water, like in our atmosphere, we would perceive that as a doubling in volume.
Mm, and you can't use sound-cancelling headphones underwater.
Yeah, exactly. The poor fish haven't got there yet.
But let's zoom in a little bit. And your research looked at two specific species, and they're actually quite interesting in that they have this mutualistic relationship. Can you introduce us to these two species?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm absolutely in love with these guys now as well. I was introduced to them through this project. And they are now an integral part of my life, to be honest. So one of them, so it's a fish and a shrimp. So it's an unlikely pair as well, which I think makes them even more cute. So we have, the fish is called a prawn goby. And these guys you can think of like, yeah, they're sort of these small little fish that sort of hang around on the bottom on the sand. Really cute, and they're not sort of swimming around like you traditionally picture fish to be doing. They sort of sit there and hang out on the bottom, just keeping an eye out, looking at things. And their little buddy is a shrimp, and it's a snapping shrimp. Some people might be familiar with these. These guys have like the one big claw and one little claw, and the large claw makes sort of this snap, and it can create these cavitation bubbles, which I think a lot of people are super interested in. And so these shrimp are really cute little shrimp as well. And so these guys have formed, there's many species of both of these, so many species of this fish and many species of this shrimp as well. And they all form different relationships. So sometimes the relationships are obligate, so they have to be in a partnership together. And sometimes it's sort of facultative, which means they can come in and out of partnerships together. Mm. And I was looking at an obligate relationship. So these guys have to be together to survive. And so it's sort of this little mutualism or symbiosis between the two. And essentially what happens is the shrimp's incredibly good at digging holes. And so they dig this really nice burrow in the sand. And that's sort of the house that they both reside in. That's their refuge. If they need to escape predators or when they need to sleep at night, they can hang out in the burrow. But the problem is the shrimp aren't as good at detecting predators. Well, this is traditionally what we thought. There's some new research to suggest this might not be the case. But we believe that the shrimp weren't as good at detecting predators, and so they needed help. And so essentially the goby, the fish, is acting as this sentinel, and they sort of hang out the front of the burrow and keep watch, defend their little territory. They look out for predators, and the shrimp is just sort of constantly going in and out, maintaining this burrow, cleaning it, redigging it, renovating. And it's incredibly cute to watch. I've ended up watching hundreds and hundreds of hours of videos. So sometimes I think I feel like I'm merging into one of them myself.
Which one would you be?
That's a great question. I think I'd be the shrimp.
I personally would want to be the shrimp as well.
Yeah, the shrimp sort of, it's just sort of carefree because the shrimp doesn't ever have to, you don't have to do it. All you have to do is just sort of crack
dig
on with
a
your
hole.
Job. Yeah, yeah. And yeah.
And I love digging holes.
Yeah, you just get to play in the sand, make sand castles. Mm. So for us as researchers, this is really strange, and it might not be strange when you first hear it, but we have to remember that one of these individuals is a fish, which is a vertebrate, and the other one is a shrimp, which is a crustacean or an invertebrate. Mm. So these are incredibly different species, right? And they're living in super close quarters, like living together and relying on one another for survival. Like it's so integral that they can't survive without one another. So this is a really unique partnership. And then it's intrigued researchers for a long time. So there's been a lot of work done looking at how they actually communicate. Because this is sort of like, we think about ourselves and our dogs being able to communicate, but at least we're both mammals. This is like us communicating with like a butterfly or something. It's crazy. But like communicating to the degree that you can trust yourself survival on that individual. Mm. So this is a really, really interesting thing. And researchers are sort of discovering that there's this huge suite of different sort of fin movements the goby uses, and the shrimp sort of rests its antenna on it, whatever it's doing. It nearly always has one antenna touching the goby. Mm. And so the goby has this really cool sort of, you could almost think of it like sign language way of sort of communicating with the shrimp through different touches. Wow. And it's every time a new paper comes out, it just seems to be more and more complex. It sort of started out with, oh, okay, they can warn them of approaching danger. And then we realized, oh, they can actually also tell them, they can translate almost the degree of danger as well. Yeah, the complexity is building, and I wouldn't be surprised if we've still got a long way to go to fully understand.
You're listening to Out of the Blue on 3CR Community Radio. And if you just joined us on today's show, we're talking to Jack Manera, a PhD student from Monash University, about his research into noise pollution. Jack has specifically been researching how boat noise might impact the mutualistic relationship between two different species, a fish, a prawn goby, and a snapping shrimp, who rely on one another for survival. And so I asked Jack about how he went about designing his experiments.
So these guys live in the sort of Indo-Pacific region, so everywhere from here in Australia on our east coast all the way up through Japan. So they're quite dispersed. And so they're always hanging out on sort of these shallow sandy beds on the edges of reefs. So they're quite often they're coming into contact with boating or recreational fishing activity, ecotourism, even around ports. They're obviously being exposed to cruise ships as well, or cargo ships. Different types of boats will produce slightly different noise characteristics, and different animals have different auditory structures, so they also perceive these noises differently. And so we thought this was a really cool system where we've got these two super different species living together and reliant on one another, but the organs in which they hear sound are completely different.
Mm.
And so they hear sounds differently. And this is why to our knowledge so far, they don't rely on auditory communication with one another. It's because they have such different perception of sound. And so we were interested, we thought, okay, well, when it comes to a lot of the boats that these shrimps and gobies are experiencing in the wild, they've got typically one of two different types of combustion engine. They've got either a two-stroke engine or a four-stroke engine.
Can you give me a demonstration of what they sound like?
Yeah, I can try. And I'll give you a bit of explanation before I do the noise, otherwise it might sound weird. So four-strokes tend to have a bit more acoustic complexity. Like nearly all car engines all combustion car engines are four-stroke engines. And so these tend to be a bit slightly lower pitch to the human ear. more like a a two-stroke engine is what you'll find in like a lot of whippersnippers, chainsaws, certain types of dirt bikes or motorbikes. It's more of like a
so very different sounds.
And to the human ear, they're very different. Surprisingly, when you look at the waveforms of the sounds they produce, they're not as different as what perceptually they seem incredibly different. Anyway, so these are sort of the two most common boat engines that are used. The important part is they do produce different sound.
Mm.
And so essentially what we did was we drove these different types of boats around above different burrows. We ended up finding 123 partnerships, which was awesome.
That must have been really fun. Were you just snorkeling looking for fish?
Yeah, very sadly, it was during COVID, so I wasn't actually there. I was stuck here in Melbourne, so I was getting told everything remotely. I would have much preferred to be on the Great Barrier Reef looking at fish during COVID.
But driving around speedboats.
Yeah. What a life. Yeah, it's like I'm here in my 5 kilometre radius doing one run a day.
And watching your little videos of fish.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so essentially there was people going around scuba diving, finding these burrows, setting up these big like camera systems, and we'd sort of just leave them there so that the shrimps and gobies got used to that. So once they sort of acclimated and gotten used to being filmed, then we could drive boats around and look at how it affected their behaviour. And we wanted to look at a lot of different behaviours, but it's really hard to manage because, as you can imagine, this is in the wild and on the Great Barrier Reef, and there's so many things happening. It's hard to pull out certain behaviours without all the noise. And when I say noise, I mean
experimental noise.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Not auditory noise. So like a perfect example is one, we had more than 123 burrows to begin with, but one of the burrows while we were filming it, a giant stingray came along and pretty much engulfed the entire burrow.
Oh my God, sand, he ate them. Oh no.
So that was absolutely heartbreaking.
But cool to get on camera.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it means it's sad because I watch it back now. No. Yeah, so there's obviously all these different things happening. There's all these various behaviours. But for now, we're sort of focused on what appears to be probably the most important for survival, which is just refuge use. Because obviously they both rely on this burrow to hide from predators. And we suspect typically with other noise pollution studies, animals tend to respond to noise pollution as a threat, or at the minimum they respond as if it's increasing threat levels. And what I mean by that is the animal is either hearing the noise and thinking, oh, that's a potential predator, I'm scared, or it hears the noise and it's sort of like this cognitive distraction. It'd be like being in a really loud place, you feel like you can't concentrate, and so they'll then hide anyway because they feel like they...
Sensory overload, I totally get that.
Yeah, and it genuinely is sensory overload. And it's this noise pollution can affect things like their smell and their taste.
Really?
Which is crazy, yeah, because they just get this full sensory overload because they're not used to having so much noise and this sort of kind of noise either. And so we would expect that they would take refuge in their burrow. And indeed, that's what we saw. So both the boats had different effects, actually. So we found that boats with four-stroke motors affected the gobies more, the fish, which was really interesting. So they sort of spent a third of the time that they would normally spend out of the burrow, they actually were spending inside the burrow, which is bad because if you spend too much time in your burrow, then you're not out looking for predators, you're not out defending your territory, keeping intruders away, things like that, even mating opportunities as well. And so this is a big trade-off. If you spend more time hiding when it's not warranted, then you're losing the capacity to be able to perform these other important behaviours. And then we found the flip with the shrimp, where the shrimp wasn't affected by the four-stroke, but it was affected by the two-stroke. And so they were then spending about a third of the time that they typically spend out of the burrow inside the burrow. It means they can't maintain the burrow because constantly when you watch them, they're constantly bringing out sort of armloads of sand and dumping it out and forming these really cool, they make these really nice like radiating runs out from the burrow. So they have these channels to
like a landscape gardener.
Yeah, exactly. Like one of those, the Japanese sand gardens. Oh, yeah. It's so beautiful.
So that's interesting that these two different species, I guess because they do have those different structures to hear sound, but they respond differently to these different boat noises, and I guess that might aid them in their mutualism because they're not both afraid by the same things.
Yeah, and that's a great point. It's hard to predict. It could show that because they have different sensitivities, or maybe the flip, they have different they're robust to different noises. It could mean collectively that they're more robust. But it also could mean that because they're relying on the behaviour of the other one, for instance, if the goby's spending more time in the burrow, that means it's not spending as much time looking out for predators. And so the shrimp's now having to risk its life to continue to maintain the burrow. And so maybe the shrimp is being affected indirectly because of this. And this is why we were so interested in this system, is because these two rely on each other so much. But then to sort of suggest the counter of that, we also looked at their communication and we found that their communication was robust, which was really cool. So if the goby was spending more time in the burrow, the shrimp, when the shrimp would come out, would still be able to keep an antenna on the goby and just sort of do things on the edge of the burrow and wait until the goby comes out before it moves away and starts performing those other behaviours, and vice versa. So if the shrimp was spending more time in the burrow, the goby would hang right near the burrow's entrance so the shrimp could always come back and sort of contact the goby and check out what's going on.
So their little sign language is robust to these changes in sound. I wonder if this will lead to different species developing their own kind of sign language, but as in the increase in sound in the ocean, I wonder if that'll put a selective pressure. Yeah,
and so that's a really cool point. There was a study done, I believe it was on a species of damselfish that live around the pylons at ports in Italy. And they found that the fish near the ports, so typically the males actually make these noises to attract females. They sort of sing to the females, which is really cute. The males would sing to the female to attract them in. But when they're near, well, the ones that live close to shipping ports obviously had a lot of noise. And they started to find that the males started to displays. So they'd do more like sort of physical displays to the females, and they weren't relying on singing anymore. And the females were starting to prefer the males that had these really elaborate displays as opposed to singing displays.
Interesting.
So it does show that animals have this sort of plasticity and ability to adapt their behaviours in response to human change. And this is sort of why this research is so interesting, because half the time we're finding that animals are sort of adapting in their way of life around us, and then other times they just can't change fast enough to the rate at which we are changing the environment.
So I guess then it's on us to not rely on these animals changing their behaviour to survive, but changing our behaviour.
Exactly.
And so what ways can we reduce noise pollution in the ocean?
That's a very hard question. A lot of the important and big ticket items need to come down from policy and legislative changes. But for us, I think abiding by sort of boating rules and regulations, there is actually a lot of boating rules and regulations that do assist with this and reduce our impacts, particularly on biodiverse hotspots, like the jet ski exclusion zones and things like that. These are all in place not only for human safety, but also for environmental safety. Boating speed regulations as well. So there's been a lot of research showing the way that you drive a boat can have a huge influence on how much noise pollution it produces as well. I understand a lot of people rely on boating. A lot of people's livelihoods, particularly in the Indo-Pacific region, rely on boating as well. By no means people need to stop boating, but yeah, just abiding by a lot of the rules and regulations and best practices, at least that's minimising our effects. And then it's important that places or people involved in sort of ecotourism, so these are like the wildlife boats that will take you out to see whales and things, I think maybe some more self-reflective or a better appraisal of the literature and understanding potentially how they can minimise their effects, that'd be really good, because they obviously go out targeting these biodiverse hotspots. And so sort of sadly, although they're promoting people's appreciation and awareness of these animals and these ecosystems, they also are sort of selectively going and polluting in these systems.
A fine balance to strike there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it's incredibly important that we have ecotourism. But as long as people in those industries are aware and they're trying to make as little impact as possible, that's good.
Beautiful, Jack. It's been a delight to have you on the show again and to hear about your really interesting research. Look forward to having you on again.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Cheers.
You heard it here first, folks. When you fang it on your speedboat or your jet ski, not only are you being an absolute tool, you're also freaking out the fish man. So just slow down, take it easy, and think of the shrimp. If you're interested in hearing more about Jack's research, you can find it on his website, which is www.jackmonera.com. You can find that link in the show notes and all the previous episodes of Out of the Blue on 3cr.org.au/radioblue. And that's it from us this morning. Stay tuned for Out of the Pan coming up with Sally just now. Until next time, stay salty, friends.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.